This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
12:03 on Tuesday afternoon, April 23rd. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. Chicago's North Avenue Beach will see the return of a summertime favorite. We'll learn more about that in our next segment. But right now, as the Bears announced they'll reveal a stadium renderings tomorrow, there's more on the White Sox quest for a new ballpark. Let's get the latest from Greg Hines, columnist, Crane Chicago Business. Greg, thank you for joining us today. And looking at all of the qualifying statements from the source close to negotiations who talked to Cranes, you could drive a train through some of those qualifying statements, but it sounds like Jerry Reinsdorf, a general partner of the Chicago White Sox, owner since 1981, is willing to put up some of his money, one figure up to $200 million toward building that new ballpark in the South Loop.
Rob, that's right. The context here is that Chicago has two sports teams that have made it clear they want new homes, and then they want the public to play a big role in the form of subsidies in paying for those new homes. The Bears lately have been scoring more successes, I think, on the public relations front. Their rollout of their plans tomorrow is already gotten, even before it happens, huge coverage. So here you have Jerry Reinsdorf, who says, hey, I want a new stadium, too. But like I said, the Bears have been kind of beating him to the public relations punch. So his team let it known that, well, Jerry is willing to do what Mayor Johnson said and put some skin in the game, providing that certain conditions are met. He didn't specify that, but I think the offer is legitimate. The question is, does that put the Sox fully back in the game to the same extent as the Bears? Because they're both clearly competing for public attention and public money.
On the one hand, it seems like the Bears have a much nowhere near as steep a hill to climb, because they want to build a stadium immediately south of their current facility. All of the infrastructure needed to supply a football stadium is already there, and the Bears could also tap into an NFL fund that allows them to build new facilities. Meanwhile, the White Sox want to move to a new facility that requires lots of infrastructure improvements. I mean, it's been an abandoned rail yard since the late 60s, and that makes the Sox job a little more complicated compared to what the Bears are trying to do.
Well, you're correct that there's complications about the proposed Sox site, but there's also complications about the proposed Bears site. Among other things, they want to go on the lakefront. The lakefront advocates, Friends of the Parks, has been vigorous in planning and threatening legal action. They have to overcome that. In addition, although we'll see the details tomorrow, all indications are that the Bears need something in the range of more than $1 billion in public subsidies in the form of infrastructure. Got to tear down Soldier Field, got to repurpose it for parks, have to build road improvements and other kinds of improvements. So the truth is, both of these teams have their hands stuck out and say, hey, public, help us pay for it, even though both are owned by very wealthy individuals, the McCaskies and Reinsdorf.
Now, the fact that the White Sox are willing to, according to this source, meet the city on their demand and include up to $200 million of private investment in the White Sox ballpark project in the South Loop, does that mean the veiled threats to move to Nashville or sell the team to somebody who would move the Sox out of state, does that mean those threats really, that leverage doesn't exist?
Well, that's kind of the hidden argument here that maybe favors Reinsdorf a little bit. Nobody thinks that the National Football League is seriously going to let the Bears move town. So the amount of leverage they have in terms of what they can get, how much the public is willing to contribute, is limited, particularly when Governor Pritzker, who would probably have to sign off on any subsidy deal, has been saying, hey, billionaires don't need help. Why should the public invest? Whereas the Sox have, at least to some degree, a little bit of a credible alternative. They can move out of town. Reinsdorf has said that he doesn't have any plans to move, but at 88, he ain't going to be here too much longer, and his sons might well decide that the financially prudent thing is to move it to other towns, and there are indeed other towns that are seeking a baseball team. So he has a little bit more of a little leverage there, I think, than the Bears do, although the Bears certainly are viewed now as more glamorous and exciting, and, you know, this is showbiz, and in showbiz, the glamorous, exciting project tends to get the public support.
Greg Hines, columnist, Crane Chicago Business, thank you for breaking down the latest moves on the Sox and Bears quest for new stadiums.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Castaways Beach Club, formerly known as Castaways Bar and Grill, will open on North Avenue Beach in time for summer. Let's get the details from Anthony Stefani, partner of the Stefani Restaurant Group in Chicago. Anthony, thank you for joining us today. And on a day in which we have cloudy skies and temperatures in the upper 50s, what a time to talk about those hot, sunny days in July or maybe June and just grabbing a drink out there on North Avenue Beach. I mean, what does this mean to you that a new and improved Castaways is opening at the end of May?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. And it's very exciting because this is a special place to myself and my sister, especially, you know, working on this project because we grew up, you know, working every summer for the first, 12 years of our lives, in the workforce at this location, and just knowing the potential of it. And, for so many years, we had the crowds out there, and it was our training into the restaurant industry. So, I mean, we're extremely excited to be able to now refresh it, you know, update it a little bit, put some upgrades in there, and draw a new clientele, but also have the returning clientele come back and get to see it.
And for those of you who may not be familiar with the geography of Castaways, we're talking about North Avenue Beach, and that is the boat-shaped building that is on the lakeshore, visible from DuSable Lakeshore Drive. It's right there when you get off at North Avenue. It's right there next to the water. And this is going to be kind of a new and improved Castaways. So what is going to make the latest version different from previous iterations of Castaways from years gone by?
Sure. So we're going to be installing some pretty much really refreshing the whole thing. So, new tiles, new paint jobs, so new look. Like you said, everybody can see the giant boat on the beach from Lakeshore Drive. You see it in the background on the news. So it is really a focal point. So we want to make it look, you know, the best that we possibly can. We're also going to have some new bars that we're adding to it on the north and the south end of the boat upstairs. We're going to have some cabanas that we'll have on our north end where our live music typically plays. Our south end we extended beyond the point that we've had, so we're going to have a lot more space on our south end to do corporate functions, happy hours. So really it's about giving different experiences to different clienteles. We don't want to just target one client. We just don't want to target the club goers. We want to target the local neighborhood people, the tourists. So we're really giving, you know, different experiences on different part of the boats, where the north end will have that more clubby experience with the bottle service and walk-up bar. And then we'll have the restaurant, you know, lining the east and west sides, where we'll have an upgraded menu with global beach fair, and then that south end will be more geared towards events, like I said, with happy hours and corporate function.
Anthony Stefani, partner of the Stefani Restaurant Group, which will be opening a new Castaways at North Avenue Beach at the end of May. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, tips for making a good decision when buying a car, whether it's used or new.
Discussing the news affecting your money. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
If you're in the market for a car, used or new, preparation is the key to getting value. Let's get some tips from Matt Jones, spokesman for True Car in Los Angeles. Matt, thank you for joining us today. And before we talk about the ins and outs of buying a vehicle, what is the current state of the car buying market? I mean, there was a time not too long ago, a couple of years ago, when the supply chain was such that the dealer basically held all the cards. It was, do you want the car or not? And if not, there are like 15 people behind you. Does that level of leverage still exist?
No. And it's good for consumers and it's good for dealers. Inventory has loosened up. There's choice now. Inventory is there. discounts are back, rebates are back. So today's car market looks a lot more familiar to people who haven't bought a car in the past 10 years. It's going to feel more like what we're used to.
Now, if you're going to finance a vehicle, it's always important to be pre-approved for that car loan before you walk into the dealership. But with interest rates where they are in the 6 and 7% range for a car loan, how much shopping around should you do? And is the dealer's credit department a good idea under those circumstances?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the dealer's credit department is still a good idea, because where most Americans will have one or two banks to choose from or credit unions when they're doing their shopping around, a good reputable dealer might have as many as 30 or 40. And some banks are just better for some people depending upon their circumstance. So just for ease of choice, selecting or allowing a dealer to be involved in the credit selection, I think it's a good move. And to your point earlier, you still want to walk in pre-approved, so you have your baseline, you know what's what. But there's often a chance, just because of so many choices, that a dealer is going to be able to get a consumer something better than what they have for themselves, and it works out for everybody.
And then on that financing component, it seems like a lot of people are gravitating towards loan terms longer than 5 years just because they want that lower payment in this higher interest rate environment. In the end, you probably pay more in interest over the course of that loan. Is it possible to refinance a car loan? Can someone get that 5 or 6 year term with the idea that one day they could refi, or does that really happen in the car space?
Well, it could happen. It doesn't happen as much as it should, but a car is just like a home or a student loan. When rates get better, in theory, it should be able, there should be options for a person to refinance. But the key to that is paying down that balance on that longer term loan as quickly as possible. And an example would be if somebody signs up for a 72-month loan and their payment is $400 per month, try to pay $425 or $50 if you can. That will reduce the principal faster. And there's two things that happen with that. The faster you reduce the principal, the less interest you pay. I think most of us know that. But the secondary is the lower your principal amount, the easier it is to refinance if rates do become more normalized back into the threes and fours that we're accustomed to, making it easier for somebody to refinance. So it can happen. Not enough people take advantage of it, though.
Great advice. Matt Jones, spokesman for True Car in Los Angeles, thank you for joining us today.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Video released by Chicago police shows a man who may be connected to the killing of Chicago police officer Luis Huesca. A judge considers complaints by prosecutors at the Trump hush money trial that the former president has violated a gag order in the case. Travel Tuesday, it's destinations in the Midwest that have a decidedly European flavor. The parent company of some Chicago supermarkets is closing stores. WBBM Business. The markets are higher. The Dow is up 275 points. NASDAQ up 233. S&P 500 up 59. 58 degrees right now in Chicago under cloudy skies, going up to a rainy 63. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. Chicago police have released video and images of a person of interest in the killing of Officer Luis Huesca. The details from WBBM's Nancy Hardy.
The department is sharing surveillance videos from two convenience stores. In them, you see a man wearing glasses, a hoodie, two different coats, and different pairs of shoes. Detectives believe he was in the area of 56th and Albany in Gage Park Sunday morning. Officer Huesca was shot and killed just before 3 a.m. as he returned home from his shift, still in uniform. Police are calling the man in the video a person of interest, not a suspect, but warn the public to consider him armed and dangerous. You can see the videos on our website. Nancy Hardy, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
A judge is postponing a decision on prosecution requests to hold former President Trump in contempt of court and fine him for a social media post that they say violated his gag order. Prosecutors in the historic hush money case cited 10 posts on the Trump Truth Social media account and campaign campaign website that they believe breached the order. Meantime, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker has testified that during the 2016 presidential campaign, he often ran stories suggested by Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are trading higher today. We're joined by Jeff Kilberg, founder and CEO of KKM Financial, based in Chicago. Jeff, thank you for joining us today. And it seems like the story of the week so far, and of course, it's only Tuesday, Jeff, is that markets like what they see from earnings season so far.
So far, so good, Rob. You're absolutely right. But we're really just getting into the teeth of earnings season. We're seeing nearly 150 S&P 500 names kick off this week with their earnings reports. But the Magnificent Seven, the stocks you hear so much about, almost ad nauseum, we will see Tesla kick off. We also see earnings from Facebook, which is now Meta, of course, Microsoft, and then Google later this week. So four of those Magnificent Seven stocks will be presenting their Q1 earnings reports. So that's really going to help us with short-term direction of the marketplace, as we have seen a little bit of a 5% correction over the last couple of weeks in the month of April.
Now, what's the street looking for from the Magnificent Seven? Do they want all seven to, in fact, be magnificent, or can they live with a Magnificent Three and a so-so four?
Well, I'm going to separate Tesla from Magnificent Seven. Tesla is actually out after the bell today, and I'm optimistic because we've seen this is the second largest drawdown, down nearly 65% from all-time highs. Tesla has an opportunity to deliver as we continue to see sentiment sour. But the rest of the Magnificent Seven, I think the bar is quite high. So we're going to see this AI, this artificial intelligence undercurrent, and as we see more enthusiasm around the AI theme, I think these names are really going to have to deliver to keep their valuations. If you think about it, that Magnificent Seven, Rob, it makes up nearly 30% of the S&P 500. So the other 493 stocks are the rest of the S&P 500. So it's really important. It's kind of the linchpin of this rally in the marketplace since last November.
We're talking about today's market activity with Jeff Kilberg, founder and CEO of KKM Financial in Chicago. And moving into, though, before the Magnificent Seven kind of takes over the market activity this week and becomes the story, it seems like the overarching theme is that a number of these companies have reduced, have come up with revised guidance to the upside so far for 2024.
That's right. And I think when you look at GM as a perfect example, up over 5% today after their earnings report beat on the top and bottom line. But that full year profit forecast you're talking about, that forward guidance, that's what we're really seeing investors really adhere to, due to the fact that's going to help us better understand what the rest of this election year looks like. As we're seeing interest rates, don't forget, Rob, interest rates are surging. We're seeing the 10-year note back up above 4.6%. So a lot to contend with. Then you put a little sprinkle of geopolitical tension. We are seeing a little bit of skittishness, a little bit of nervousness in the marketplace.
I do want to zoom in on one stock in the streaming media space, and that is Spotify, because I think it echoes what we saw earlier from Netflix, and that Spotify may have been or may be one of the few streaming media companies to actually turn the corner into profitability. Of course, they did a great deal of cutting in staff and shows leading into this moment, but they issued a much better second quarter guidance. The revenue picture is strong, and it seems like as streaming services incinerate money in order to get stars and premium programming, it appears to have actually made that pivot to delivering audiences at scale that can be monetized.
It did, and I think where it really hit the nail on the head was their premium subscribers, Rob. You saw Spotify hit a record profit because of the growth. That base grew to $615 million, but a lot of their profits or their margins are coming from that premium subscription. So this is a big deal for the first time in their 17-year history, and I think you'll continue to see tailwind in Spotify.
And then very quickly, UPS up just a little bit after the delivery giant posting better than expected quarterly earnings. But revenue is still down on a year over year basis. And could we see that as an economic bellwether? I mean, when you have a company as big as UPS, what does that mean when revenue is down year over year?
Well, you know, that's the cross current that we're still trying to grapple with, Rob. And you bring up a great point, because the strength of the consumer, which has been the backbone of this rally in the U.S. economy and the stock market the last 5-6 months, we see a little bit of a cross current, a little bit of a question mark people are not sending packages like they used to. What does that exactly mean? Well, maybe we're not spending like we're used to. So that could be a little bit of a canary in the coal mine with UPS.
Jeff Kilberg, founder and CEO, KKM Financial in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Travel Tuesday, how you can have a local vacation with a European feel.
Information to make cash and save cash. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Travel Tuesday, and today we're exploring a touch of Europe in our own backyard. Welcome in Mark Wolters, Wolters World Travel and Culture. Find him on YouTube. He's also a teaching associate professor of business administration at the University of Illinois Geese College of Business in Urbana-Champaign. Mark, thank you for joining us today. And you don't have to, if you want a taste of Europe, basically, Mark, but you don't want to book a 10-hour flight, possibly, that costs thousands of dollars and pack your passport, you can get that taste of Europe just by getting in your car and driving to some places in Wisconsin or in Michigan.
Yeah, there's actually a number of places, and I think you put it perfectly when you said a taste of Europe, because if you go to places like New Glarus, Wisconsin, for their little Switzerland vibe, or Holland, Michigan, for the Dutchness of the Netherlands, or Pella, Iowa, if you want to go a little bit farther, they really do a great job of bringing the food from Europe back to the U.S. You actually get to know, was grandma's version of the pancakes the same as they had back in the motherland, right? And so in New Glarus, you have, you know, all this little Switzerland. So if you want the fondue, you want the raclette, the different cheese stuff, the bakeries, they have that. But what's cool is they have this, like, Swiss historical village, which basically is an open-air museum for, like, what it was like 1,800 years ago. Or if you're going to go to Holland, Michigan, they actually have the newest. It's basically a theme park where it's basically a Disneyfied version of the Netherlands. So you get that vibe. So it's a nice taste of Europe. So you can have a nice, like, fun entry-level experience into some of these countries.
Now, this is some valuable information, Mark, for those people who associate New Glarus, Wisconsin with spotted cow beer. There is so much more to New Glarus than just New Glarus brewing. And, of course, I'm a big fan of Holland, Michigan myself. And I know that the Tulip Festival is coming up in Holland, if it hasn't happened already, soon, late April, early May. And that is an international event. It brings in people from all over the world checking out Holland, Michigan. But there are some places, though, that may require an airplane flight. You can get that touch of Greece in Florida, not too far from Tampa.
That's right. Tarpon Springs, my wife's Greek as well. And so we've gone there many times to get a Greek taste again. I know Greek Town Chicago's got some great restaurants, but honestly, if you head down to Tarpon Springs, it's really like you're back in Athens having the original food. And there's all this sponge diving there as well. They brought in these divers from Greece, and so the culture kind of came in and the food. Lots of artists there to give you a really nice, like, Greek vibe where you're sitting outside in Greek-like weather all year round versus, you know, Chicago, it's not quite Greek weather all the time.
And and you can also get that taste of, speaking of tastes of Europe and North America, you can certainly get that in Montreal and Quebec City, which was an itinerary that my wife, then fiance, and I did about 14 years ago. We went to Montreal and to Quebec City. And the thought that I always had when walking the streets of Montreal or Quebec City is that this is like an alternate universe where Napoleon conquered America. You really do have to speak French or ask people if they speak English before you do anything in Montreal or Quebec. It is that it's the French language and the French culture is that prevalent when you go to that part of Quebec.
It is. And if you're going to choose between the two, if you really want to feel like in Europe, I tell everyone the most European city in the entire Western Hemisphere is Quebec City. And when you go there, whether you go to the lower city, which really takes you back to like 1800s France, or you go to a little bit higher, it is such a fantastic experience, and they have great buskers that are there, just like you have in Europe. The food is straight out of France. I mean, it is an incredible experience to have. It's a little bit farther to go, but well worth it.
And the old city of Quebec is great because they have that old Grand Hotel that is in Quebec City overlooking the St. Lawrence River. And it's just one of the most beautiful vistas you will find in North America. When I went back in 2010, Mark, we went on Canada Day, which if you know the history between the Quebecois and the country of Canada, Canada Day in Quebec is moving day for a lot of people. It's a holiday in the rest of the country, but not in Quebec City.
Yeah, there's a little difference. That's one thing is when you explore Montreal and your Quebec in general, the whole province, you definitely get a different vibe. So it definitely has much more of a French independence feel to it when you go there with the flags and the food and the language. So, yes, Canada Day is a very interesting day to be going there.
And do yourself a favor if you do go, pick up some, do what I did and pick up a Montreal Expos and a Quebec Nordiques t-shirt, because that's the only place you can find them. Mark Wolters, Wolters World Travel and Culture, find him on YouTube, also an associate professor of business administration at the University of Illinois Geese College of Business.
Compounding your interest with an economy of words, this is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Foxtrot Market and Dom's Kitchen and Market are closing stores. Let's get an update on this surprise move with Ali Marotti, restaurants and retail reporter, Crane Chicago Business. Ali, thank you for joining us today. And a social media image posted by Channel 5's Marianne Ahern at one Foxtrot location showing that there's a sign on the door saying, "We're closed for good. This is not a joke." So this is something that happened today. What is going on with both Foxtrot and Dom's?
Yeah, so it was pretty shocking, I think, to consumers and also to suppliers, but we can get to that in a minute. Foxtrot Market and Dom's Kitchen and Market, both Chicago brands, both founded here. They merged less than 6 months ago, and then today we have this news that they are closing all of their stores and shuttering their parent company. We don't know exactly what is happening financially yet or why this is happening. We do know a source familiar with the matter confirmed to us that investors in both companies were informed this morning that the parent company would be shutting down. And then the stores started closing this morning as well.
Foxtrot is a trendy convenience store, for lack of a better term, and Dom's is the upscale grocery store, which was introduced in Chicago with great fanfare not too long ago. What you can't talk about the specifics because we don't know them yet, the specific financial reasons for shutting down, but both entities appeared to be under stress leading up to today.
Yeah, so it's been interesting to watch. So we can start with Foxtrot. It was founded about a decade ago. The founder started it kind of as a business, you know, project when he was going to Booth, and went from there. And it did really well for a long time. It expanded quickly. It operated under this interesting model where it kind of used its stores as fulfillment centers for its online orders. That served it really well during the pandemic. It was able to rope in a lot of customers as people started buying stuff online. You know, it raised a bunch of money, over $160 million, I think was the latest count. And it had this pretty ambitious plan that it rolled out in 2021 to open 50 stores in 2 years. That turned out to be too ambitious. You know, the markets kind of shifted. It wasn't as easy to get money anymore. Foxtrot did layoffs. You know, we saw several other Chicago startups do layoffs around the same time. But then Dom's, similarly, you know, Dom's was started by this cohort of grocery store veterans, including Bob Mariano, who founded Mariano's, of course, right? We also have, you know, people who worked at the now defunct Dominick's chain, and they were able also to raise a lot of money right out of the gate. They only had two stores open, but they had plans to open others as well. They had announced one in River North. They were going to take over the old Whole Foods space there. They announced one in Fulton Market and out in Vernon Hills as well. And then for Foxtrot's part, they had about 33 stores, plans to open more. So, you know, they had kind of, that's why I think it's going to be so shocking to people, is because we've all watched them over the past couple of years really explode onto the scene here. But opening new stores is really capital intensive business, and grocery stores have very thin margins. So you can see just with those facts about the industry and about the operating model, how things might have went awry.
Thanks for the insight, Ali Marotti, restaurants and retail reporter, Crane Chicago Business.